What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.
The Economist.
Hello, and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm Ora Ogunbiyi.
And I'm Jason Palmer. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world.
Grueling wars fuel desperation, and Gaza is no exception. People are ransacking homes and selling the loot at local markets, and gangs control the storing and distribution of aid. Our correspondent looks at the shadowy economy that is gripping the enclave.
And after today's total eclipse races across North America, it'll be nearly a decade before another is visible from somewhere in the United States. And even then, only Alaska will see it. Yet eclipses can only be said to be rare if you stay in one place.
First up, though.
Every year on April 7th, Paul Kagame, Rwanda's president, leads a ceremony to commemorate one of the most grisly events of the 20th century.
Our hearts are filled with grief.
Sunday's remembrance service for the Rwandan genocide was characteristically somber as the nation marked three decades since the start of the killing.
Rwanda was completely humbled by the magnitude of our loss.
30 years ago, armed militias from the majority ethnic group the Hutus slaughtered hundreds of thousands of their countrymen, nearly all of whom were from the minority Tutsi group. The genocide took just 100 days and left the country scarred.
And the lessons we learned are engraved in blood. But the tremendous progress of our country is plain to see, and it is a result of the choices we made together to resurrect our nation.
For Mr. Kagame, the ceremony is a chance to highlight his role as a statesman, to remind the world that he not only led the army that toppled the murderous regime in 1994, but also went on to turn Rwanda into a beacon of progress in East Africa. But that's not the only side to Mr. Kagame, who's led the country since the end of the genocide.
I think any visitor to Rwanda today could not help but be impressed.
John McDermott is The Economist's chief Africa correspondent.
The capital, Kigali, has gleaming buildings, an impressive convention center, and it feels like a prosperous, thriving African capital. According to the IMF, GDP has grown by around 8% a year from 1995 to 2022, which is Chinese levels of growth, albeit from a pretty low base. And Rwanda has used the aid money that it still pours into its budget pretty well. It has brought down child mortality and increased life expectancy. And while there are some critics who are rightly skeptical about some of the data behind these improvements, there is no doubt that Rwanda is both in a better place than in 1994 materially, but also better than some of its neighbors, including, say, Burundi.
I mean, much of that is really quite positive, but we've spoken on the show before about Mr. Kagame and a fairly polarized view that a lot of the world has about him.
I think it's just worth remembering, Jason, that the genocide remains the absolutely fundamental context for everything that Mr. Kagame's ruling Rwandan Patriotic Front does. It was such a momentously traumatic event When I was in Rwanda recently reporting the story, I went to a town a little way south of Kigali called Nyamata, and I went to see a church where 5,000 Tutsis were killed during the genocide. It was a strangely beautiful day on which to visit the church. There was birdsong in the background and the sound of kids playing from a nearby school. I was greeted by a tour guide who showed me around.
So this was the original door of the church.
You notice on the outside all the bullet holes on the wall.
And then you can see the roof with the blood stains, even some shrapnel from the hand grenade.
And still to this day.
Yeah.
Inside, you see mounds of clothes upon the pews. And these are the clothes that the victims wore. I remember distinctly seeing a dress of a two-year-old.
No, this is heartbreaking. I mean, this must be a dress the same size as my daughter's.
Oh, are you married?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I have three children, three young children.
Oh, wow.
It's impossible not to be moved by the harrowing scenes. So there's a part of you that asks, well, why would you not have public policies that try to reconcile people? But Mr. Kagame's government has put in place broadly interpreted laws around what Rwanda calls divisionism or genocide denialism or terrorism. And these have been used to lock up journalists, commentators, opposition politicians. The repression that is being done in Rwanda in the name of avoiding another genocide or minimizing ethnic hatred is so extensive that critics are surely right when they say these laws and the efforts by Mr. Kagame's police state are not just about never again, but they're also about protecting the ruling regime. There's also a whole other spate of criticisms, which is more to do with how Mr. Kagame operates in the region.
What do you mean by that?
Ever since 1994, Rwanda has meddled in its much bigger neighbor, the Democratic Republic of Congo. It was heavily involved in the first and second Congo Wars that began in the 1990s. And then in the aftermath of the second conflict, it gave support to a rebel group, which is today known as the M23. Now, Rwanda denies helping it, but the UN says there is plenty of evidence that it does. Now, for Rwanda, when it does talk about its involvement in eastern Congo, it suggests it's all about self-defense and the protection of Tutsis that are living there. But critics say it's also about exploitation of Congo's vast mineral resources and, frankly, about Mr. Kagame wanting to be the regional big man.
I mean, we started off talking about what Mr. Kagame had done for the country, but most of what you said here suggests that he must not be seen as a force for good in the country or the region.
And yet you'd be wrong. Elsewhere in Africa, he's hugely admired because of the progress that Rwanda has made since 1994, and a sense in which he is a strong leader. He runs an efficient, if authoritarian, government, and stands up for Africa against the West and promotes Africa's interest.
But where does that leave his reputation then with people in the West?
Mr. Kagame is probably the West's favorite African autocrat. Initially, that was because he was a president of a country that was spending aid money well. And their support for him was also influenced by their feelings that the West did not do enough to avert the killings in 1994. Nowadays, I think it's much more about realpolitik. Britain has struck a deal with Rwanda to send asylum seekers to the country. America has been relatively critical of what Rwanda's up to in eastern Congo, but it's still the largest donor to the country. France supported the old genocidal regime, so it's always had a difficult relationship with the Rwandan Patriotic Front. But in 2021, Mr. Macron went to Kigali and asked for forgiveness for the French role in the genocide.
Seul, ceux qui ont traversé la nuit peuvent peut-être pardonner.
An act that Mr. Kagame thanked him for.
This was a powerful speech with a special meaning for what is taking place now and which will resonate well beyond Rwanda.
Rwanda is fighting jihadists in northern Mozambique, close to where Total, a French energy giant, has a huge gas project. It's also sent troops to Francophone countries, including Benin and the Central African Republic, where France has been worried about the increasing influence of Russia. Mr. Kagame has mastered the transactional diplomacy that is so important today. He's seemingly on good terms with both America and China, with UAE and Qatar, with Russia and Ukraine, which is opening an embassy in Kigali soon.
So what next, though? What does Mr. Kagame's leadership look like going now into its fourth decade?
The next elections are this year on July 15th, and there is no doubt that Mr. Kagame is going to win. The only question is whether he'll get 97%, 98%, or 99%. Some people will say that's because he's very popular for all the good things he's done. But at the same time, the Rwandan Patriotic Front has also quashed all viable opposition. Regardless, he looks like he will be in charge for at least the next 10 years. Following a change to the constitution in 2015, he will be able to run the country until 2034. And I think this gets to the really big question as Rwandans and the rest of the world look back at the events of 1994 and what's happened since, which is, how stable can Rwanda really be today if it is so utterly dependent on the rule of this one man?
John, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Jason.
World peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world. And in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Israel is winding down a mission in the south of Gaza. The state has been under increasing pressure to relieve its reservists and is preparing troops for an assault on Rafah, Gaza's southernmost city. The United Nations estimates that since October, at least 80% of Gaza's 2 million or so residents have been forced to leave their homes, often with nothing more than what they can carry. Many of them moved to the southern part of the enclave to shelter. But now, with Israel withdrawing more soldiers, some displaced Palestinians are beginning to return home. What will they find when they do?
Northern Gaza is in a partial state of anarchy. Obviously, Israel has taken control of that and says it has largely defeated Hamas in that part of Gaza. But we're hearing lots of cases of people who have fled and then managed to return, getting back to their homes to find out that they've been broken into.
Gareth Brown writes about the Middle East for The Economist.
When the Israeli army came into Gaza City, they conducted quite a thorough search of many of the buildings, many of the homes in the city. And that involved, you know, blowing the doors off buildings, off houses, which made it very easy for groups of Palestinians. Some of them are organized, some of them are less organized and perhaps more opportunistic, going into these homes and looting the things that they find inside.
Gareth, tell me what that looks like for individual families.
Many of these individuals and these families, they've been through 5 months of war. They've been displaced perhaps to the south of Gaza. They've spent many months outside of their homes. I spoke with one woman from Gaza City, Suha Alam. She fled her home in the early months of the war and she went south. And she managed to get a message to some family and friends who were still in Gaza City and asked them to go and check on the house. And when they did go and check, she found out that much of the furniture had been looted. Now she can't get back to the north. She can't get back to Gaza City. So she's currently living in a tent in the city of Rafah, with the knowledge that whilst her home hasn't been destroyed, it's been looted of almost all its internal contents. So, you know, this only sort of compounds the feeling of hopelessness.
Where is this stuff going? I mean, there can't be an enormous market right now to pick up new household items.
There's not a huge market for things in Gaza. It's a wartime economy, but there is opportunity in this state of conflict. I've even heard some stories of people who have gone to these flea markets, which are springing up, and actually bought back their own furniture, which had been looted. Now, we're talking about small markets, which are mainly only functioning for a couple of days before they move. These markets are a small part of an emerging patchwork economy, which we've seen develop since Hamas have been pushed back in Gaza. And it's an economy where clans, local mafias, and even established Palestinian businessmen can use their know-how and muscle, and in some cases links to Israel and Egypt, to fill this vacuum.
So these groups that are angling to fill the power vacuum left by the fall of Hamas, that are capitalizing on this lawlessness, are they new, or how has this come about?
Some are new, some are old. Many of these groups are firmly tied to Gaza's clans or big families. Gaza is a tribal society, and long before Hamas, the biggest clans and families were seen as power brokers within the strip. When Hamas took control of Gaza, they did have some quibbles with some of these bigger clans, but they soon started to learn that it was better to work in conjunction with the clans, the big families, instead of trying to fight them. So, you know, Hamas has been largely militarily defeated in Gaza City, and many of the institutions have been destroyed. The universities are destroyed. The hospitals are barely standing. And what do you have left? Well, it's these social structures which go back hundreds, if not thousands of years. For many people, the clans, you know, big groups of cousins, brothers, are the only sort of thing that they've got to lean back on. So the clans and tribes have always played a role in Gaza, but now what we're seeing in this vacuum and with the dire humanitarian situation is they're playing a role in the distribution of aid. And we can describe them as being both the firefighter and the arsonist. In certain cases, we know that some NGOs are essentially indirectly paying the clans protection money. They're paying them because they have warehouses in their areas and they can keep the aid safe. They're paying them to keep the trucks which are taking aid from Rafah to other parts of Gaza. But then we also see other clans sort of playing a role on the other side and actually being involved in the organized theft of aid, which is then sold at these extortionate prices, simply unaffordable for many people in Gaza.
But is there any alternative to these groups and clans?
Well, in the long term, these clans are going to continue to play this role. They're probably always going to be around. But something that might ease the anarchy, the lawlessness, is the re-establishment of some sort of authority within Gaza. Now, many international actors, you know, not least the United States, have talked about giving the Palestinian Authority a role in Gaza. Now, that's the Ramallah-based Palestinian body that sort of administers parts of the West Bank. However, that's an idea that is fiercely unpopular in Israel, and it's something that Benjamin Netanyahu has publicly rebuked on several occasions. As long as there isn't that central authority, whether it's Palestinian or perhaps something linked to the United Nations playing a role in Gaza, these clans are going to fill that space because it's what they've always done and they're not going to go away.
Gareth, you've painted a picture of anarchy in the Strip. Is there any way to escape that?
Well, ending the war would be one, but I think there are a few ideas which the UN and humanitarian workers say could really help this situation of anarchy. One of those is flooding Gaza with aid. That's the kind of language that the UN's humanitarian coordinator in Gaza likes to use. And basically, the idea behind that is you get so much aid into Gaza that you devalue all this stuff that's being looted. So you're sort of pulling the rug out from under the feet of the gangs, the clans, the mafias, who are making significant sums off this humanitarian aid. So that's one idea. Another idea is helping people in Gaza access cash. Now, the Palestinian Money Authority, which is based in Ramallah, says that just a handful, perhaps only six of the 91 ATMs are online. So it makes it very difficult for the 2 million people there to get money and buy the products they need. And that feeds into their desperation. That feeds into the lawlessness. And then I think most interestingly, we've seen America moving forward with building this floating pier off Gaza's coast, which basically would be a new route to get aid into the Strip. But if you speak to humanitarian officials, what they say is that aid, even if you get it to the pier, it reaches the shore of Gaza, it's still going to have the same problems that aid coming in over land via Rafah is. And that's distributing the aid within Gaza. All of these ideas focus on easing the desperation and suffering of the Palestinians in Gaza. But for now, what is developing is what was described to me by one former Palestinian official as warlordism. And it's Israel who is deciding who the new power brokers are in Gaza.
Gareth, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Our most recent edition of the Weekend Intelligence discusses the man who many Palestinians want as their next leader, the politician turned revolutionary Marwan Barghouti. With a prison release on the cards, it's becoming a real possibility. We dropped the paywall on this episode so that non-subscribers can listen and enjoy.
Trips across North America make for good adventure stories, and today's is brought to you by the moon. A 200-kilometer-wide spot of total darkness will start off near Mazatlan on Mexico's Pacific shore at about 11 a.m. local time. It'll race northeastward, crossing the Texas border just 20 minutes later.
The last time this happened in central Indiana was more than 800 years ago.
And the best spot for totality is far western Kentucky.
In a 20-minute period of totality in the state of Ohio. And as far as the points...
In a little over an hour, it'll cross 10 more states, sweeping across into Maine and heading to Canada, where it'll paint a dark path all the way out to Newfoundland. Along 7,000-ish kilometers of that path of totality, millions and millions of people will get a rare treat, a total solar eclipse, glimpsed hopefully through specialist glasses or projected through a pinhole in cardboard. But why is that treat so rare? That is the kind of query taken up by The Economist Explains, our series of short, sharp articles on questions raised by current events.
I've seen four eclipses in my life. The first was in 1999, and when I went to see that, I thought that would probably be enough. But I was so taken with them that I decided that I would go back and see some more.
Jeffrey Carr is our senior editor for science and technology.
The main thing that drew me was the extraordinary experience, the extraordinary phenomenon, which looks to me like a black hole punched through the sky. It's surreal, and it's something that I would recommend anybody go and see at least once. That particularly applies to those in North America who are able today to make it as far as the track of totality.
So let's start with what eclipses actually are. What are they?
An eclipse of the sun happens when the moon comes between the sun and the earth, and the moon's shadow falls on the earth. It, curiously, is on the cusp between two subtly different astronomical phenomena called transits and occultations. A transit happens when something passes in front of a star without obliterating it. Transits of Venus and Mercury, for example, happen as viewed from Earth. An occultation is when the intervening body just obliterates the star behind, and that's what a total eclipse is.
So how rare is a total eclipse of the sort that some will see today?
Overall, they're not so rare. They happen on average once every 18 months. The first I saw was in Turkey in 1999, the second in Australia in 2002, and then the third and the fourth were rather more exotic because the one in 2003 was actually in Antarctica. I flew down with a bunch of like-minded individuals in a rather shaky Russian transport plane, and we spent 26 hours on the ice and watched the eclipse, which was an extraordinary thing. And then the final eclipse that I've seen so far was in 2010, and that was visible from Easter Island. But in any given place, they are extremely rare because the track of totality is very narrow, so you can only see the total eclipse from a small part of the surface. For those who are less obsessive about A, eclipses, and B, travel, if you're living in North America, this is a good opportunity to see one. The last one visible there was in 2017, and the one before that was in 1979, so they're not that frequent.
But you say they happen somewhere on the earth every 18 months. It's just that they're carving out paths where people may not be. Why don't they happen more often than that?
Well, if the orbits of Earth around the sun and the orbit of the moon around Earth were in the same plane, then they would happen every month. But you would only be able to see them from the tropics. However, the moon's orbit is tilted with respect to the Earth's orbit around the sun. And that means you can get an eclipse almost everywhere. But it also means that there are months when you don't get an eclipse at all. And that's why they're rare. And that's why you can ultimately, if you waited long enough on any bit of the Earth's surface, one would pass over you.
So for astronomers, then, it's fairly boring if it's all a very predictable business.
It's not boring. I mean, it's predictable. But astronomers have used eclipses to study the corona, which is the thin layer of plasma superheated by the sun's magnetic field that surrounds the bright bit of the sun, which is called the photosphere. It used to be the case that an eclipse was the only time you could see the corona and study it. Now we have telescopes which can create an artificial eclipse by blocking out the photosphere, but they still also block out the bit of the corona which is closest to the sun, which is where a lot of interesting stuff happens. So it's still worth an astronomer's while to study an eclipse, because you can learn something about the inner corona. You can learn other things as well. The famous case back in 1919, an eclipse was used to test Einstein's general theory of relativity, which was only 4 years old then, and predicted that a massive body like the sun would attract light rays towards it and therefore distort the positions of the stars behind it if you viewed it during an eclipse. And an expedition went out and found this was true.
Still one of my favorite experiments. So I personally haven't seen one of these things, but I gather if I sit still long enough, I will eventually?
That's correct. You will. Any part of the Earth's surface can see an eclipse. But that won't be true forever, because the moon is receding from Earth. It recedes at a rate of 3.8 centimeters a year. This has been measured by reflecting laser light from mirrors set up by the Apollo astronauts. This is caused by tidal friction, but it means that the moon is gradually appearing smaller and smaller in the sky. So there will come a point where it's so small that you can no longer have a total eclipse. Fortunately for eclipse watchers, this will not happen for 600 million years.
Yeah, I didn't have that long to just sit around and wait anyway. Suppose I want to chase one of these things down as you do, as you have. Where should we be going next?
If you don't want to wait 600 million years, the next eclipse will be in August 2026. And it'll be visible in Greenland, which is the sort of place that I might like to go and watch one, but also in the north of the Iberian Peninsula, Portugal and Spain. So if you want to go somewhere sunny, I would go there.
I say we go to Greenland, Jeff.
Let's do it. It's a deal.
Thanks very much for your time.
Yeah, deals.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. Let us know what you think of the show and all of our premium content by emailing us at podcasts@economist.com. And we'll see you back here tomorrow.
As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.